I'm Darren Kaster, your host. You are listening to this week's edition of The Green Majority. We've got a couple of things on the way today. First off, we're going to be speaking to Ilnitsky from 350.org Toronto, which is the Toronto chapter of Bill McKibben's organization, doing some local stuff. We're going to be talking about divestment campaigns and the like. Following that, we've got Will Simpson, who's going to be talking to us. He's from Salon Escape. They're using some interesting techniques as far as reducing their carbon footprint and, you know, being a green business and all that good stuff, except that because they're a salon, one of the things that they're actually doing is apparently using the hair trimmings that they cut off people to soak up oil spills, which is really neat. So we're going to be finding out exactly how that works a little bit later. And then should we have time, I've been sort of taunting you with this a little bit for the last few weeks, but if we have time, I've also got the story of Stuff Cosmetics as a backup there. We may or may not get to that. We'll have to see just how the flow of everything goes. First, I want to welcome, of course, Kevin Farmers in the studio today. Good morning, Kevin.
Morning, Darren.
So just before we get to 350 Toronto, one of the ones that was, I sort of found one of the stories that we came across this week, I sort of found it amusing and then less amusing as I read on. But somebody apparently dumped what appears to be something to the extent of like a ton of dippity-doo hair gel or something like that off the coast of the UK there. We've got hundreds of birds coming in with an oily substance all over them. The report seems to be that they haven't been able to pin down exactly what the substance is, but it does appear to be from some sort of to be dumped from some sort of ship. And as far as they can tell so far, it is not like engine fluid from the working of a ship. So it's not like a poorly maintained ship or anything like that. It does appear to be an illegal dump, although they don't know for certain. Did I miss anything, Kevin? Was there any other details?
No. What I was reading was that it had sort of the consistency of petroleum jelly. And what's truly unfortunate, I mean, among all of the unfortunate things you can say about this is that as far as the birds are concerned, the stuff seems to be immune to soap and water, and they're having a really hard time cleaning the birds. And if they can't clean them, the birds can't survive. And it does appear to be an illegal dump. It really does. That some unscrupulous operator is dumping some mysterious substance. It's just, you know, in this day and age, you would think, you know, the moral imperative would be stronger with regards to protecting the environment. But still, you can read stories like this and realize how far we have to go with public consciousness.
Well, I mean, it sounds like the good side of it is that they are promising that if they're able to track down who actually did it, that they would be seeking legal action against them. Of course, you'd expect that, that they've said that they would do it. However, there seems to be somewhat of an admission that there's going to be some difficulty tracking it down unless they can specifically identify the substance. So,
yeah, unless they can identify the substance and maybe get a satellite photograph of traffic during, you know, if they can pinpoint sort of where it was released and then when it was released, and maybe get a satellite photograph of traffic during that time, and that, you know, they can narrow down the investigation. I wouldn't hold my breath. It seems like a very daunting task.
Yeah, where are those James Bond spy satellites when you need them, huh? Anyway, so we're moving on from that. We've got more news stories later in the program. However, I would like to move on to our first guest, which is Milan Ilnitsky. Thank you very much for joining us from 350.org Toronto. And we were going to be talking today a little bit about some of your campaigns. The first one, if you wanted to just introduce yourself a little bit and tell the audience a little bit about who you are first.
Certainly. Thank you for having me. So my name is Milan Ilnitsky. I'm a PhD student in political science at the University of Toronto and a junior fellow at Massey College, and I'm also the president of the Toronto 350.org chapter. We're a relatively new group. We were formed just this past summer, but we consist of a group of volunteers who are working to encourage the transition to a low-carbon global economy in Toronto. So our two big campaigns at the moment, one of them is in relation to the Enbridge Line 9 pipeline, which the company is trying to reverse to carry diluted bitumen from the oil sands through the Toronto area. And the other is we're encouraging the University of Toronto to divest its portfolio from fossil fuels, starting with Shell.
All right, so let's start with the first one then, a little bit about the Line 9 issue. One of the articles that we actually did an interview about with somebody a few weeks ago was based on an editorial that was in the Huffington Post where the argument was from our guest that essentially fighting individual pipelines, for instance, he was proposing was potentially the wrong fight and that we should be going after the oil industry in general. What are your thoughts on the success or failure or the effect of going after individual projects as opposed to attacking the oil industry as a whole? How do you feel about that sort of issue as far as tactics is concerned?
I think targeting individual pipelines has been quite effective so far. What it does is it introduces uncertainty into the development plans in the oil sands, whether they're actually going to be able to ship the product that they're hoping to produce. So by introducing uncertainty about the fate of projects like Keystone XL, which 350.org has worked on a great deal, the Northern Gateway Pipeline in British Columbia, projects like the reversal of the Line 9 pipeline, we can reduce the potential future export capacity. And given the unwillingness of the federal government and the government of Alberta to put meaningful limits on the release of greenhouse gas emissions, at this stage, blocking pipeline construction is one of the more effective tactics we have available to us.
All right. So talk a little. You said it's been able to produce uncertainty and that it's been successful. Can you talk about some of the other issues that you've seen some success with?
In terms of the pipeline?
With as far as like pipeline or just blocking specific projects in general. And has this something that you've seen success with and that's why you're following that model?
Well, you can look at the Keystone XL example, which is in many ways a big surprise. I think there was an expectation that the Obama administration would approve it with relatively little consideration. But there has been this huge public outcry and people sort of raising the big question, which is about the future of our energy system. And are these the kind of investments we ought to be making for the next 50 years or the next 100 years? Should we, given what we know about climate change now, be effectively doubling down on fossil fuels? Or should we be investing in alternatives?
Mm. So one of the criticisms that was made, just speaking of Keystone XL for a minute, was that we had the news story that came out, would have been a couple of years now, about some massive protests. I believe Bill McKibben was at it. There was a massive protest on Capitol Hill a couple of years ago, Keystone, and then U.S. President Obama stopped considering the bill. We put in the context on this program of him basically punting the decision until after the election. At the time, it was considered a victory, however, and everybody was celebrating. We now see that this project, as predicted, may have simply been punted. But we saw an article come out a few weeks ago, I'm not sure if it was last week or the week before, about Jim Flaherty actually expressing public concern about Obama's conviction to finishing that pipeline. From what you've seen, what is your personal opinion on both the project that you're working on, how confident are you that you might be able to stop the Line 9 reversal, and then as well other projects like Keystone? How are you thinking? Is public opinion and pressure building enough that these projects will actually be stopped? How successful do you think you're going to be able to be?
Well, I can tell you a bit about the history of Keystone XL and 350.org. I was there in Washington, D.C. in August of 2011 when the first big Keystone protest took place. I believe it was the largest act of climate-related civil disobedience in American history up to that point, with more than 1,200 people getting arrested in front of the White House to protest this pipeline. And so it did result in the delay of this decision. The pipeline needs approval from the State Department because it crosses an international frontier. So we are actually going back to Washington, D.C. next weekend for February 17th for President's Day. About 8 of us from Toronto350.org will be participating in another protest, this one perhaps even larger, again calling on the president to reject this particular proposal.
With the amount of investment that's already been done, we did another interview with the southern half, a gentleman from Texas actually, that was protesting the already largely implemented southern component of the pipeline. Do you not feel like perhaps that at this point that so much has already been invested that it's unlikely that this will happen, or do you really think that the Keystone can be stopped?
I think with the investments we're making in fossil fuel infrastructure, we're kind of setting ourselves up to pay three times. We're building the wrong infrastructure, and at some point not too far in the future, we're going to realize the seriousness of climate change and realize how inappropriate it is for us to be building all this oil, gas, and coal infrastructure. So then we'll have less time to build appropriate energy infrastructure, which will increase the costs of doing so, and we'll have to deal with more climate change, so our adaptation costs will increase. Mm. So we're really setting ourselves up to pay three times.
So your position is that despite all the money that's been spent, it will be even more expensive to not continue. You don't agree with the point of no return of investment on that point?
Well, the big economic issue when it comes to fossil fuels is that those who are producing and using them are considering only the immediate economics. You know, I can produce a barrel of oil for this cost and I can travel this far in this vehicle with it. But what they're not considering is the long-term impact that arises from the greenhouse gas pollution that inevitably results when you burn fossil fuels. And the greenhouse gases we're putting into the atmosphere now are going to persist for thousands of years. They're going to raise sea levels and cause all kinds of global disruption. And all of those costs really need to be factored into the calculation. And when you factor those costs in, fossil fuels just don't make sense at this point.
Mm. So if those numbers are solid, then how does it stand to convince government to take action on this? I mean, if there is, as you say, solid numbers and solid science behind the risks of climate change and the ideas about how to delay the effects or reduce the effects, how does that get translated into policy? How do we get, if those facts are true, how do we convince government to act on those facts?
It's a big challenge. And one of the reasons why it's challenging is because of the time horizons that governments think across. Governments are thinking about maybe the next 3 to 5 years, whereas we need to be thinking about the impact that our choices are going to have over decades and centuries in the future. If we keep doing what we're doing now, we're setting ourselves up to disintegrate the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets and significantly raise global sea levels with all sorts of other international climatic effects. So we need governments to pay attention to those long-term impacts. And one of the ways to do that is by encouraging institutions that have a longer-term perspective, like universities, which are thinking decades and centuries into the future, to start thinking about what they can do to help aid this transition to a low-carbon global economy.
So as we mentioned at the top of the hour there, 350, you're part of 350 Toronto, which is part of a larger organization, Bill McKibben's 350.org. Perhaps, you know what, just to make sure that everybody's on the same page, before we get to that, let's just confirm that everybody understands the significance of the 350 number. Why is it called 350.org?
350 refers to the parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Before the Industrial Revolution, so before about 1750, the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere was about 280 parts per million. And we've now increased it to about 393 parts per million, and we're adding 3 parts per million every year. And the higher that number goes, the more total climatic damage the world is going to suffer, and the higher the risk that we're going to encounter these tipping points whereby we induce large permanent changes in the climate system. And there are tipping points that can themselves cause further warming. For instance, if we cause the Arctic permafrost, which contains vast quantities of methane, to melt, that can cause warming over and above what we're causing through fossil fuels. So the 350 target relates to the level of warming which maybe avoids the most dangerous possible impacts of climate change. If we can stabilize the atmospheric concentration at 350 parts per million, we're unlikely to see more than 2 degrees Celsius of warming globally, and we're unlikely to see some of the really scary tipping points take place.
Right. And so as you already outlined, just to emphasize, we are in fact at this point past that number.
We are, but if we were to aggressively curtail global greenhouse gas emissions, it's still possible to get back below 350 parts per million because the oceans have a capacity to absorb carbon dioxide. So if we just stopped emitting greenhouse gases today, much of what's in the atmosphere now would enter into the oceans. So by adopting an appropriate mitigation pathway, it's still possible for us to achieve the 350 target, though it requires significantly more energetic action on the part of governments around the world than we've seen so far.
So kind of a way to describe that effect would be like kind of like if you had a frying pan on the stove and you turn down the heat a little bit, the frying pan doesn't immediately change the new heat, but it sort of edges in that direction. And so that's what we're looking at. By reducing the gases in the atmosphere, it'll slowly edge back in the direction of the climate that we're used to, basically, is how that works. Yeah.
Basically, we can think about two huge stocks of carbon, one of which has already been added to the atmosphere, and one of which resides in the coal, oil, and gas reserves that exist around the world. And if we choose to burn all of those reserves, we'll dramatically increase the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. We'll take ourselves to over 1,000 parts per million, and maybe 5.5 or 6 degrees Celsius of global temperature increase. So at this point, the real challenge is to keep as much of that carbon as possible underground.
Okay, so getting to where I was going to go with that question originally, as we started, the 350 Toronto is a local chapter of a larger organization. One of the issues that we've talked about many times on this program with the difficulty in interacting or trying to lobby as a citizen, your federal government, is that a lot of their decisions are, obviously, you're only one of their inputs. You know, ideally, you're their input. They're there as, you know, public servant, and you should be their only concern. But in reality, we all know that that's not true. They have investors and financiers and backers and oil. There's also other governments, right? We live in a globalized world now, so they have to negotiate with other governments. You know, Canadian government's concerned about things like free trade with the U.S., NAFTA agreements, and all sorts of stuff like that. So when we're talking about that, a lot of the issues at global climate talks that we've talked about before are issues about getting various countries to agree on stuff, and that has been the biggest problem with moving forward. For instance, the U.S. being able to come to some sort of agreement with China about who should pay the costs, you know, the people who industrialized first or the people who are putting the majority of the pollutants into the air now. So how do we around that, seeing as a larger whole, your organization really is looking at this on a global level, how do you interact on a global level? Is this a variety of ways of various groups, various 350 groups in various countries interacting with their own governments simultaneously? Or how's the way forward as far as getting governments to cooperate with other governments to get this stuff done?
Well, despite how the long-term impacts of climate change unfold over decades and centuries, the decisions we make in the next few years are going to be absolutely critical for determining which pathway the world ends up on. And as a consequence, it's necessary to take action essentially at every level. And that's what 350.org and other organizations are doing. We're not restraining ourselves to lobbying national governments. We're looking at provincial governments, municipal governments, at private corporations, at institutions like the University of Toronto. All of these organizations have a role to play in the transition that the world needs to achieve, and we're trying to use creative strategies to encourage that transition.
Okay, so let's take a pause there from the Line 9 kind of bigger climate change issue, and let's get down to the issue of University of Toronto. As we've been over a couple of times now, you're the local chapter. There are other chapters inside of Canada. Listeners from our program are listening from all over the country, so you can sort of answer in a generalized sense for our national audience. But can you talk a little bit about exactly what it is that you're trying to do? What does divestment mean, and how does that apply to something like a university? What is their role in and how they affect climate change at a local level?
So the university has large investments, both in terms of their endowment and in terms of pension funds. And at the moment, many of those investments are in fossil fuel companies. Now, one thing to be aware of is if you look at a company like Shell or Exxon, their market value is based on the assumption that they're going to be able to burn the reserves of coal, oil, and gas that they own. But what we know from climate science is that we just can't burn that quantity of fossil fuels. And as a consequence, a lot of the apparent value of these companies is illusory. So we're calling on the University of Toronto to divest its portfolio from fossil fuel stocks, beginning with Shell. Shell is actually the university's largest investment. They have about $10 million invested. And as you probably know, Shell is now investigating drilling for oil in the Arctic. So they're taking advantage of the climate change that's already taken place in order to cause even more climate change. So again, it's about this transition, and it's about what kind of future do we want and what kind of investments will get us there. And continuing to invest in fossil fuels just won't do it. So by redirecting investment, we can aid the transition. And also, the university can protect itself from some of the risks associated with how the value of these companies depends on this assumption that they're going to be able to continue to use the atmosphere as a free dumping ground for greenhouse gas pollution, which may just prove to be untrue in the medium term.
As someone that's done a little bit of study themselves, I took some classes specifically on climate change science. So I'm not an expert by any means, but I'm an educated novice on the issue of climate science. And one of the things that I can tell you right away is that it's a very complex issue. A lot of the questions don't have easy answers. It's something very much similar to when we talk about the issues around nuclear power here on the program. Is that there's lots of people on lots of side because it's a complex issue. There's no kind of easy way to explain everything. So I find it very understandable years ago how a lot of people could be confused about how climate change worked or doubt that it existed because it's such a complex issue, right? And it's so easy to find ways that to think, well, that doesn't matter because of this. But you have to really understand the really heavy details of how it works. So we live in a time when I get frustrated when I meet someone that doesn't, you know, understand the basics of climate change or understand the gravity of the risks. However, when you look at things like, for instance, one of the things I remember from a Bill McKibben video that I watched was him talking about, you know, why are we even exploring drilling for more oil and gas? We can't afford to put the carbon in the atmosphere from the stuff that we already have on hand. So how can we do it? So, I mean, I think that's one of the issues is that, you know, for a lot of people, they're like, well, how can the climate change alarmists, quote unquote, be right about this? Because if that was true, we wouldn't be digging more oil and gas, right? If there was solid science saying that we couldn't afford to burn any more, we couldn't afford to burn what we've already got, much less drill more, then why would governments be drilling more? So can you comment a little bit on just like the people that you meet when you talk to people on the street, or when you're just sort of dealing with people who aren't necessarily part of our, like, you know, we spend way too much time reading environment news type crowd. How do you communicate this information to someone that maybe doesn't have the science background and maybe is a little bit skeptical, you know, not for ideological reasons, but just purely out of the fact that they're misinformed or badly informed about these issues? How do we convince those people that this is a real issue?
Certainly. Well, the science of climate change, I agree with you, it's very complicated. And we have, you know, 50 or 60 years of major research being done on it. But what that research shows, and what we can now be very confident about, is some of the key dynamics of the climate system. And the key dynamic is, when you add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, you cause the planet to warm. And we've already added a dangerous amount of CO2 to the atmosphere. And if we continue to behave the way we're behaving now, we're going to see serious impacts. And if we want to avoid those impacts, we need to curtail our use of fossil fuels. And there's no scientific doubt about those key dynamics. Like, specific questions, like exactly what kind of climate impact will a particular region experience, or exactly where will we see particular tipping points manifesting themselves? There's substantial research still being done on questions like that. But in terms of humanity's future with fossil fuels, we have a clear answer. We have the answer that if we continue to use fossil fuels as the basis of the global energy system, we're going to experience a dangerous amount of climate change.
So with the idea of divestment campaigns specifically, one of the things that we sort of talked about before the show was the idea that you're not simply advocating about taking money away from places, because I mean, that sort of seems like if someone was to look at that, you know, just like, oh, well, you know, you're just trying to, you know, affect where, you know, take money away from people you don't agree with. But it's not really that. What you're talking about is almost less divestment and more reinvestment. You're interested in taking money away from oil and gas to put it into renewables. Can you talk a little bit about the strategy of what type of investments you are interested in making?
Well, one curious thing about the energy system is that people don't tend to have direct engagement with it. People, it doesn't matter that much practically whether your refrigerator is running on energy from coal or oil or gas or nuclear or solar or wind. So effectively what we need to do is take the global economy, which is currently kind of propped up and supported by fossil fuel energy, and shift to a situation where it's being supported by the renewable forms of energy that we can rely on indefinitely. So there are kind of two components within the economy. There are all the parts that we rely upon, that, you know, people work at and that supply us with what we need to stay alive. And then there's the current energy basis that's supporting that economy. And what we need to do is replace the energy basis. So we're saying, don't invest in the forms of energy from the past that have no future, but maintain your investments in the economy as a whole and invest in the forms of energy that can continue to support that indefinitely. Like, what's kind of exciting about the transition to renewable energy is that since the Industrial Revolution, we've been relying on these fuels that are inevitably going to be depleted and that cause all kinds of additional harm just by using them in terms of the toxic pollution that fossil fuel use produces. But once we build a sustainable global economy, it will be able to function indefinitely, and we'll have a society that runs on sunlight and wind and which we can perpetuate forever.
So we're just pretty much out of time. I want to thank you very much for joining us, but I do have one final question, which is sort of my fun question that I sarcastically like to ask as many people as I possibly can, which is that the Green Majority is on a mission to find out exactly why there are oil subsidies. I have not yet, but to date, Kevin, am I wrong? Nobody's given us a good reason.
No, not even an inkling.
No, I mean, I've been trying, perhaps, you know, to be honest and to be fair, all kidding aside for a minute, we've of course been asking all the people on our team, as it were. So I mean, perhaps we're asking the wrong people, but do you have any proposal at all as to even cynically as to why oil subsidies exist? Why do we as Canadian citizens, many of us who are having trouble paying our rent and keeping jobs and getting food on the table during the tough economic times, why are we handing money from our paychecks to the richest companies on the planet? Do you have any explanation for that at all?
Well, there are many types of oil subsidies, ranging from the most direct to the most indirect. The most direct are maybe reduced prices for heating oil or gasoline, which exist in some countries. And you can see why those are popular with consumers. And other forms of subsidies include reduced taxed bills or special treatment for investment. But really, the big subsidy is ignoring the costs associated with pollution. That's the kind of big subsidy that society as a whole and governments are giving to fossil fuel companies. And the reasons why those subsidies exist are because some of them are directly popular, like reduced costs for fossil fuels for consumers. Some of them serve influential corporations that have political clout. And because we just haven't yet taken into account those real pollution costs and created systems of governance that will get them under control.
So in Canada, the I'm sorry I don't have the exact number handy, but when we're talking about oil subsidies, all the companies combined, oil and gas and everything, and you add up the kind of the whole fossil fuel economy in Canada, we're in the billions of dollars of subsidies. What you're saying, though, is that there's additionally even more that we're not putting into those numbers. Those numbers could theoretically double or triple because we're not accounting for the costs of doing business because those have been externalized and not accounted for. If you had to ballpark, how much higher than what is being accounted for would the costs of the negative repercussions be?
Well, in some ways, I think it's even misleading to talk about the cost of climate change exclusively in terms of dollars. Like, if we disintegrate the West Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets, that over the course of centuries would raise global sea levels by 14 meters. That's destroying New York City and London and the Netherlands and Bangladesh. And you can talk about those costs in terms of dollars or in terms of the risk associated for the rest of the university's investment portfolio from causing that sort of damage. But think about the human suffering. Think about how these are areas that have been inhabited for all of human civilization and the risks that we're imposing on future generations. And in some ways, I think the costs are much more moral than economic.
Mm. So, you know, quite literally wiping ourselves off the map.
Certainly significant parts of the inhabited world.
All right. Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank you very much for joining us, Milan Ilnitsky from 350toronto.org. Would you like to give people some information if they're interested in finding your group or any of the other local groups in Canada, contact information, anything you'd like to give to our listeners?
So people anywhere can look at 350.org, 350.org, which is the main website for the organization. People in Toronto can look at our site, which is toronto350.org. We have meetings every Tuesday night from 7 to 9. So if you're interested, please come out.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you getting through the snow here to get to the station today. So thanks so much for coming on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
And we're going to take a brief music break, and then we're going to be back. I'm going to chat with Kevin about some news. We've got a guest talking about soaking up oil spills with hair products, or rather the remnants of hair. Pieces of hair left off to soak up oil, and then I haven't decided yet. We may or may not get to the story of Stuff Cosmetics. We'll figure that out as we go. It's always a random show here on The Green Majority. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. All right, and we are back. I'm your host, Aaron Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. We're going to have a quick news update from Leah Mazzolini.
Here's some news stories that have happened this week. In Canada, the environmental watchdog is worried about the rise of fracking. Stephen Harper says economic warning from Green Watchdog is useful advice. Ottawa appeals the World Trade Organization's ruling on Ontario's green energy plan. A new report says Ottawa is failing to protect Canadians from pollution. And a University of British Columbia study says mining groundwater could fuel climate change. And overseas in Europe, wind farms have been breaking an energy record in Spain. European Union regulators approve UK's £600 million Green Deal funding. Greenhouse gas emissions from US power plants are down 4.6%. And an outgoing EPA chief convinced Obama is serious on climate change. All those stories and more are on our Twitter page at Green Majority. And make sure to like us on our The Green Majority page on Facebook. And switching gears, Amber Waves, creator of the Open Till Midnight blog, is also, of course, our Canadian music ambassador, has an exciting announcement that she will be giving away some cool prize packs for Green Majority listeners only. So please follow Miss Waves at OT Midnight, or rather at OT Midnight, and maybe you can be a part of the massive Canadian Music Week giveaway. And on tap next week, it's the Canadian International Auto Show. And on Thursday, February 14th, Darren and I will be taking part and we'll be speaking with some CEOs of the biggest names in the industry. We'll be discussing what are some of the major changes being done to cars to improve environmentally, and reduce their carbon footprint.
Absolutely. I've actually already gone shopping for my fatigues so that we can slip in and out. I haven't decided if we're going to go with fatigues or ninja gear because we're going in behind enemy lines. We're going to be talking to some car company CEOs. We did it last year. It was actually one of my favorite episodes from last year. This year is going to be new and improved and even better, not only because it's not just going to be Ari Rabinovich and myself. Lee is going to be joining us. We also have a cameraman. So a lot of the interviews will actually be put on YouTube after the fact. I'm really looking forward to it. We've had our YouTube channel up for a little while. It's a really great spot to get to we're subscribed to a whole wide range of environmental groups. You can kind of look at our page and get a kind of a correlated news feed of all the other environmental channels, but we have yet to put any of our own content on it. So this will mark the first of our own content, hopefully with much more to come. We're going to try and start doing more video content as time goes by, but that will be ready. It'll be a couple of weeks. We're going to use the clips, I think, from the interviews, the audio anyway, within a couple of weeks. It may take a little longer for the video, just of course, because we're all doing this our free time because we're all volunteers, which is a good way. Part of the reason I'm reminding you is that we are slowly approaching a fundraising drive. It's going to be more than a month away, but we just like reminding people all the hard work that we did. In fact, I uploaded a picture this morning from the trying to walk into the show on the Facebook page there of just absolutely walking through a blizzard.
It's me.
Yes. It's me. Not that you can tell from the snow or the fact that you can't even see your face around your big coat, but anyhow, we made it here, and regardless, with that, without further ado, though, I would like to interview our next guest. Leah's going to stay here in the studio in case... as the person with some hair industry background to help me do the interview, but I would like to welcome first off Will Simpson to the program. Will, are you there?
I am. Thank you very much, Darren.
Thank you so much for joining us. So you've been with Green Circle Salons. You're on here on behalf of Mr. Price, who's the president of Salon Escapes. If I'm not wrong, sorry, is he the president of Green Circle or of Salon Escape?
Right. Shane is the president of Green Circle Salons. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So we are the recycling company that caters to Salon Escape.
Okay, so we found out about Salon Escape, and you work with many companies. I'm just mentioning that one specifically because Leah actually was familiar with that salon, which is how we sort of got tipped off to what's going on. So if you want to just start off and just give people a little bit of a context for who you are and how you're coming at this, how did you end up working for Green Circle Salons?
Well, I think Green Circle Salons sort of started up as a response to what we saw as a need in the salon industry for more sustainable practice. The industry has gone highly unregulated, or in some cases, like in BC, it's actually been deregulated over the last couple decades. And what we found is that as a result of that, you never know what people are pouring down the drains or what they're throwing into their local landfill. So this company was started in 2009 with a very clear-cut goal of waste reduction, helping people to sort of go down a greener pathway, and ultimately to make the whole salon industry in Canada sustainable by 2020. So that's the goal that we set out to do. And you mentioned Solana Scape. They've been sort of a leader in championing this movement throughout Yorkville, where they're based out of, and also in turn sort of bringing attention to it nationwide as well.
Absolutely. So one of the things we're going to get into some more specifics, and I'm going to ask you about exactly the bit about the hair clippings being used for oil spills in just a moment. But just to give sort of a generalized context first, we did an interview with Adria Vassal recently, who's the writer for Now Toronto and does all the Ecoholic stuff. We interviewed her about her book, Ecoholic Body. And one of the things we talked about there was about the cosmetics industry and body care industry and all the sort of dangerous chemicals that get largely unregulated put into those types of products. And she had in her book a wide range of alternatives for things like soaps and hand creams. But one of the things that I sort of associate when we're talking about hair is it's one of those things where you kind of, as far as I'm aware, it's really hard to avoid all sorts of chemicals. You've got peroxides and coloring agents and all sorts of things. Can you just, in a generalized sort of way, and talk about the hair industry in general, what sort of environmental / public, you know, health issues come up with the sorts of things that a normal salon would be using? And maybe you can give us some ideas about some of the ways that you've tried to avoid those things or make it more sustainable.
Sure. So first of all, Adria Vassal, she's a great champion also of our cause. She's helped to get some of the salons in the area to participate in our movement as well. So that's great to hear that you've been speaking with her. What we found is that typically in order to enable the high performance of salon products like styling creams, dyes, that kind of thing, some really heavy chemicals are needed. Formaldehyde, VOCs, all of these things that are sort of typical everyday cosmetic agents are in a lot of the products that most salons are using. So we don't actually get involved in recommending products to salons. What we focus on is sort of the downstream impact and trying to manage that for salons. Now, having said that, there is sort of this movement towards ammonia-free products and organic products that salons are starting to bring into their salons. But our focus is sort of, again, working towards helping people to reduce their footprint regardless of what kinds of products they use.
And I'm just going to be jumping in here.
Sure.
Hi, Will. I was just going to be, because I've talked to you before that I have a hair background. So I was in the industry before. And one of the things that I definitely saw kind of going back to color is that there was a lot of wasting of color, and that can go down the drain. Now, you said that there's actually something that you do differently with hair color. Could you explain a little bit more about what happens? How do you collect the hair color, and what happens to the hair color that is would normally go down the drain?
Absolutely, Leah. Thanks. So typically, salons when they mix up the product and they use it, they're left with 1 to 2 ounces of chemical after every chemical or color service. So what we found was that this chemical is going, you know, down our drains and into our local waterways, and it comes back. And it's not completely filtered out, so eventually our kidneys become the filter for these really harsh chemicals. The other thing is that a lot of salons are throwing them into the garbage, and they basically end up going to our landfill and leaching into our soils that way. So the alternative that we've presented is a chemical waste diversion program. So basically we provide the materials for a salon to scoop all of that extra excess chemical into a bucket. And when we come to pick up their hair and their foils and color tubes and, in many cases, paper and plastic as well, we actually take away all of that chemical, and it goes to a chemical waste treatment facility where it's then responsibly managed, so it's not ending up, again, in our waterways or in our soils.
Is there a cost to this? Is this something that is it expensive, inexpensive?
There's no cost for the chemical waste program in and of itself. But the way the whole program works, the entire waste diversion in salons, is there's basically a stewardship program that gets put into place where a small eco fee, it's less than the cost of a cup of coffee, is added to the final bill of each salon guest after their service. So if my mother were to go into a salon and pay, you know, $150 for cut, color, style, and eyebrow wax, any of those things, she would just get a very small fee that works out to about 1% of her final bill added, and that enables this opportunity across the industry.
And how successful have you found from a marketing point of view? I'm by no means a hair expert, But I know a little bit about marketing. How have you been able to, as far as convincing businesses to take this sort of thing on? You know, you're saying it's a very minimal cost, but it is a cost increase. And I know a lot of business owners tend to be a bit wary about that sort of thing if they're not already super interested in the environment. How do you go about convincing salons that this is something they should be participating in?
Well, that's a very good question, Darren. And I think that, you know, at this point, because it is something that does involve a cost, it's not necessarily going to work for the low-end salon. This is a premium service that premium salons get involved in because they understand. And what we found is that in this industry, it is very, you know, fashion-forward, and it's an industry all about trend-setting. So in that way, the industry leaders get on board, and we found that the people who follow them are typically the B and C salons. So, for example, in 2009, when this company started up, we started in Yorkville, and it was very much a premium service. And now we've been able to branch out, and we are now in Vancouver. We just launched on Vancouver Island as well, and this spring we're going to be launching in Quebec. So it is something that, you know, we've been able to branch out and make it more inclusive so that it is sort of an industry-wide solution. In the case of Salon Escape, which you mentioned earlier, Robert Barbosa, very well-known name in the industry. He's the artistic director there. And he's one of these guys who's a trendsetter, and he understood this is where the industry's headed. Again, it's been deregulated or unregulated, and it's not always going to be that way.
So just for context for our non-Toronto native listeners, that the Yorkville area is kind of like the where all the fancy shops are and the Hilton Hotel and all that sort of thing. So generally, as you're saying, this is at this point anyways more of a premium product. But you seem to be alluding to the fact that the industry itself, as a fashion industry, as a trend-setting industry, is it your opinion that potentially this is an industry that might be more susceptible to arguments about stuff like environment because it's kind of seen as it's now increasingly being seen that the environment and from a business point of view is kind of like a sexy way to do it, is that it's hip and everything like that? Do you think it's easier to convince this sort of business to take environmental initiatives than, say, another industry?
That's a very good question, Darren. I think, green has definitely been in for the last few years, and I think that, there are always going to be those people who jump on board the bandwagon because it's a fad. But we by no means see this as a fad. We see this as, you know, the way this business needs to evolve. Ultimately, again, we want this whole industry to be sustainable by 2020. And like you said, there is a cost to be on this program. So for that reason, businesses can't be expected to do it on their own. We need salon guests to also enable this opportunity. And again, you know, if you're spending $1 or $1.50 at a salon to be getting involved in this, that action, you know, with the ripple effect of everyone being involved, actually creates a huge difference across the industry.
Okay, so we're almost running out of time here. We're running pretty close to the end, so I just want to make sure we get to actually what we, in theory, had you on to talk about, which was the thing that caught our eye in the first place, which was the idea about specifically the hair and how the hair gets recycled and used for oil spills. Can you just explain that process a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So very interesting thing. Right now, 90 to probably 99% of salons are throwing their hair in the garbage. And, the sort of common perception is it's an organic material that's going to break down. But the reality is that in the conditions of a landfill, it's actually creating methane gas, which is adding to the greenhouse problem. I know before the break you were speaking about that with your previous guest as well. Greenhouse gas is a huge issue of our time. So our alternative is to take that hair, redirect it from the landfill, and actually repurpose it for a variety of different opportunities. So in 2010, after the big BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, we got involved with a not-for-profit based out of California called Matter of Trust. And with their help and the help of Redken, we were actually able to send our guests' hair down to the BP oil spill, where volunteers on the site were actually making hair booms out of the hair and a nylon stocking. So then this was basically acting as a last line of defense along the shoreline to keep the oil from coming onto the shore. And I think the really interesting thing there is that, we were talking about reliance on fossil fuels and this kind of thing. Right now, in the oil industry, the tradition is sort of to use synthetic oil booms, chemical dispersants, and that kind of thing to deal with these problems. where, you know, there's a very viable solution and it's actually growing on our heads. It's a local renewable resource that can be used for all kinds of different purposes. And we just need to sort of create these smarter, healthier systems and put them into place so that we can actually capitalize on that.
Absolutely. Well, that sounds really cool. I'm afraid we've run out of time, though. I want to thank you very much, Will Simpson, for joining us, who's with Green Circle Salons. Just before we go, do you want to give people, if anyone's interested in contacting you to ask you more questions or interested in the salon or any of the initiatives, do you want to just direct them how to reach you and your company?
Sure. So we actually have a Green Salon directory. If you visit greencirclesalons.ca, what you can do is check out the local salons in your area that are participating in this movement. And again, it's something where you can actually go onto their site and get a reward for coming to the salon. So it could be 10% off your first salon visit. It could be a retail purchase, that kind of thing. And the idea is, again, choose green and reap the rewards for it.
Yeah, and you said you're connected with salons all across the country too. So it's not just if you're within reach of the Yorkville area then.
That's right. Yeah, right now we're in Ontario, BC, and again launching in Quebec this spring.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us, Will Simpson.
Thank you, Darren. Thank you, Leah.
Thank you very much.
So we're going to take another quick break here for music. Thank you once again to Amber for providing today's music. And as Leah mentioned earlier, she is having a Canadian Music Week contest. So if you can add her on Twitter, check out the website after the show. You'll find out how to get entered for her prize pack. And all of the music we've been playing today are her picks for the favorites of this year's Canadian Music Week. So definitely check out the website. We have little reviews on and links to all the bands on the website after the show as well. Without further ado, we're going to take our music break and we'll be right back to wrap up the show. You are listening to The Green Majority. I'm your host, Darren Kaster. I am also in the studio with Kevin Farmer. And we're going to be talking just about a couple of news items before we wrap up the show today. The big one that I caught this week was the resignation of environmental critic. I'm sorry, I've lost my note on exactly what his title was.
Federal Commissioner of the Environment.
Thank you very much. Yes, and his name is
Scott Vaughn.
You can see I didn't have my notes organized with me this morning. So I do remember what the story was about. Basically, he left his federal position to become to take a similar position at a provincial level, and has basically, one of the things we've talked about on the show a lot is the sort of censorship of Canadian officials and the inability of Environment Canada to make public statements without checking with the government first. However, he was already leaving, and what were they going to do? Fire him? So he decided to put out one final report that was already due. And I think I read several of the quotes by him. And he definitely wasn't, you know, taking a hatchet or anything like that to the Prime Minister. It was very much, I think, written in the tone of what you would expect from someone who is trying not to not piss off his former bosses too much, for lack of a putting it better way. But I think managed to make the sort of pitch that would actually be listened to and considered by people on the right. Which I think was very admirable. He made an effort to talk about things like the removal of security and the removal of protection for waterways. Kevin, you read the story as well. What was your impression of what he was talking about there and some of the issues he covered?
Well, I thought he certainly mentioned some extremely important issues. He highlighted the fact that the federal government is unprepared for, say, a disaster with an oil tanker on the West Coast. It's unprepared for disaster recovery with regards to deep water drilling on the East Coast, and he brought to light some very interesting problems regarding the process of fracking or fracturing shale to get at natural gas and oil. And in particular, what struck me, I'll admit I don't know as much about fracking as I ought to. It's been on my to-do list for a while, but
on that, I would really recommend we actually interviewed the director a while ago, but I think you were on a brief hiatus at the time. But the documentary Gasland is exceptional.
Oh, okay, right. That's also been on my to-do list.
Yeah,
for
no,
a while.
Really, really
it's
good.
It's hard to keep up. The ways to assault the environment keep increasing, and my ability to keep up with the news remains finite. But, you know, for instance, the fracking process requires injecting water and chemicals into the ground to split rock and to fracture the rock formations and get at the oil and the gas. And what Scott Vaughan had pointed out in his report is that we don't know what chemicals they're using. They're actually exempt from reporting the chemicals that they use to in the fracking process. And I believe there's dozens, something like 80 chemicals. And what we know for a fact that some of them are toxic, but what he comments is that we just simply don't know what they're using. And fracking has taken off at an alarming pace. There's just thousands and thousands of fracking sites. And it's largely responsible for the recent boom in natural gas recovery in the States, and just sort of there's been a boom, and it's been due to fracking. I thought this was a good parting shot, and it forced Harper to make a comment, which was interesting. And he, you know, for instance, Harper said that obviously what we need with greater resource development is greater environmental protections, which just flabbergasted me. I was like, but you've been busy with your omnibus bills of gutting.
You spent the last 6 months with a hatchet.
Yeah, exactly. All he's done is gut environmental protections, and he never met a pipeline he didn't like. And then he said polluter pay is at the heart of this government's environmental philosophy. And to be fair, they are revisiting the liability caps on oil spills.
I think he's correct on that. I think he does actually been enforcing a polluter pays, but I think what he was talking about was by pollution was press releases put out by environmental organizations are the people that should be paying. Clearly, that was what he meant by that.
When they've been cleared by the Canadian Revenue Agency of being money laundering terrorists. So he is revisiting the liability caps on oil spills, which right now, if no negligence is proven, they're only in the tens of millions of dollars. And whereas, you know, sort of BP was on the hook for billions, but, you know, if there was no negligence proven, then the company could be on the hook for maybe $30 or $40 million in total, and the remaining billions of dollars in cleanup costs would be externalized to the taxpayer. And so those caps are being revisited, and that should be something to be said in this government's favor.
I think one of the notes here, of course, as always, we're going to post all the stories we talk about on the website afterwards, so definitely go and check out greenmajority.ca. But one of the quotes here from Scott Vaughan, from the article that we're looking at here, which was by Post Media News, was, quote, "We identified several shortcomings, including insufficient spill response tools across the federal government, inadequately tested capacity, poorly coordinated response plans, and out-of-date or missing agreements between boards and supporting departments." So he basically was using carefully chosen technical language to basically say that nobody's doing their job is what I basically
exactly.
got
yeah.
from this, was that there's a whole bunch of stuff you say you're doing that apparently is not being checked on or is just outright not being doing. Another quote from farther down talked about Labrador Offshore Petroleum Board had not completed reviews needed to ensure operators had adequately responded, could adequately respond to a spill. So there was stuff that's supposed to be doing that isn't being done. There's supposed that was said that would be done that hasn't been done. And there's stuff that has been done, which has violated international agreements, apparently, which is the commitment under United Nations treaty to protect 10% of marine areas, which was, as we discussed recently, gutted with the loss of protection of hundreds of lakes due to the omnibus bill here. So I'm really not sure kind of what more to say about it than that, other than I think you put it perfectly. It was a well-calculated parting shot from someone who was a little bit too informed as to what was going on to be able to stay in line, I guess. I'm not really sure what to say about it.
Yeah, it seemed like he was taking advantage of his situation.
Oops, sorry. And I just realized, Vera, I was going to let you talk some more, Kevin, but we are right up against the end of the hour, so we've got to go right now. It's been great talking to you. Hope you enjoyed the show. Please check out the website, greenmajority.ca. But once again, I am your host, Darren Kaster. We had Kevin Farmer and Leah Mazzolini joining us as well today. All the information, as I said, you can get the show online. And thank you very much for joining us. We'll hear from you next week.